Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
Hey, everybody. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. On today's show, with Tuesday's key election for the U.S. Senate seat in Georgia, we are going national, checking in about the state of that contest, which will determine how much breathing room Democrats have with their razor-thin majority in the Senate next year.
Plus, a changing of the guard in Washington as Nancy Pelosi and most of her leadership team make way for a new generation of Democrats, including two from California, as Bakersfield Republican Kevin McCarthy whips votes to be the next speaker. And we're going to begin, though, with Jessica Taylor. She's the Senate and Governor's editor for the nonpartisan and widely respected Cook Political Report with Amy Walter. She also covered politics and elections for 5 years with NPR. Before this, Jessica, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Always nice to have a fellow public radio hack with us, you know.
So
we're big fans of public media in general at Cook.
yes, and we appreciate that. Well, you've described this runoff in Georgia with Warnock as deja vu from 2021. That, of course, was his first election when he faced off against then the incumbent GOP Senator Kelly Loeffler. How does this one compare with that in terms of the dynamic with Herschel Walker?
Well, first of all, it's a month earlier than that January runoff was, which, you know, I'm very thankful for. It only put a slight damper on Thanksgiving and not the rest of the holidays. And I think probably Georgia voters will be happy to see just 1 month of TV ads instead of two. But the biggest difference, well, it's one race and not two. We had both Georgia Senate seats up in 2020. And this was a special election that Warnock won to fill the Johnny Isaacson seat, who had stepped down due to health issues. But it's one, but that 2 years ago, the control of the Senate was on the line. Like, if Democrats wanted to win the Senate, they had to win both of those seats and it would give them 50-50 control. So that's not the case this year. And really, Democrats were very worried that that would happen and that that would motivate Republicans, especially. That was sort of their nightmare scenario. But what happened, of course, on election night, and we found out in the ensuing days, is that really, the Senate map that we looked at, really Democrats almost entirely ran the table on competitive seats. They have not lost an incumbent yet. Again, well, Warnock would be the last one that we would see. And they managed to flip the Pennsylvania Senate seat, an open seat, to their favor. Now, they did not defeat Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, a very close race, but fell short there. So right now they are at a net of one. So it matters. So they're guaranteed at least a 50-50 majority. So if Raphael Warnock is defeated by his Republican challenger, football great Herschel Walker, then it will be another 50-50 Senate. But if Warnock hangs on, then they will have a 51-49 margin, which may not sound like a big difference, but it really is when you've had, you know, more centrist senators like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema holding up legislation. This would mean that they have, instead of ties on committees, they have one more seat on committees. So it could really make a big difference. And looking at the 2024 map, it's a very difficult one for Democrats. They're defending 23 seats, including ones in states that Joe Biden lost by double digits, like Montana and West Virginia.
So this is an important one as it stands, even with that. And we're seeing a record number of people headed to the polls, but you mentioned the shorter timeline, which I believe, you know, was something that Republicans in the legislature and the governor did in part to get potentially an advantage for the GOP, right? Do we know anything yet about who's coming out and sort of what the state of play is when it comes to early voting and the truncated timeline?
Yeah, so we've seen really heavy early voting. So there was a dispute over Democrats wanted to have Saturday voting, which would have been the only Saturday polls would have been opened after the Thanksgiving holiday. The Republicans tried to block that, but a court overturned it. So counties were given the option to be open on Saturdays. And a lot of counties, crucially in the metro Atlanta area where the bulk of the vote will come from, they were open. We saw long lines, heavy interest. On Monday or on Sunday, and then this week, continuing to see heavy lines. In fact, on Monday, they broke the record turnout for early voting. in a single day. And some of the people that have done analysis of the breakdown, it is trending slightly more African-American than the general election numbers did in early voting, and slightly more women. Now, it's down a little bit among younger voters, but those first two especially are good signs for Raphael Warnock. And I really think, you know, Republicans have almost demonized early voting and absentee voting at this point. And they do this to their peril, because if you rack up enough ahead of time and you have things that go wrong on election day, you know, we had storms in the West on election day, and that could have cost them the Nevada Senate race, perhaps. So, you know, it behooves Republicans to try to embrace this. But as of now, you still have, of course, the most prominent voice in the party, former President Donald Trump, throwing doubt on it.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned that these early votes seem to be more African-American than was in the general. We have two African-American candidates, Herschel Walker and Reverend Warnock. And then there was a New York Times article today that showed overall, including in Georgia, but throughout the country, Black turnout was down in November. So what are Democrats or Republicans doing to reverse that?
I mean, you're seeing Warnock target heavy African-American areas and Black media and different things. And you're right. This is a unique race because we have two African-American candidates. That's not something we typically see. I'm not sure if we've ever seen before.
Especially in the South.
Yeah,
exactly. In the South, especially. I guess we have with Obama, but when his Senate races. But he needs Black voters to come out. I mean, that's the core of the Democratic Party, especially in Atlanta. But the big warning sign for Walker is that he's so far underperformed the other Republicans on the ballot, including Governor Brian Kemp, who won a fairly easy reelection in a rematch with Stacey Abrams, his 2018 competitor, who came very close, that there is clearly a lack of enthusiasm for Walker among independents and among, I think, those suburban women especially. And we've seen some of Warnock's ads really try to target them. I thought one particularly good one he had features a suburban woman, middle age, saying she's voted for Republicans all her life. She voted for Kemp, but she's like, I just don't trust Herschel Walker. Like, he lies, and I just don't think he's qualified for the job. And I think this is what he's hammering home, because, again, these people, if they reluctantly voted for Walker, even if they skipped it altogether, are they going to come back out in what it will be a lower turnout election where that's the only thing on the ballot? I think Republicans have a real problem in motivating people to come out. And it's because of the type of candidate Herschel Walker was. And we saw across the ballot already that candidates with these problems that were endorsed by Trump that had substantial baggage, I mean, Herschel Walker has about a football field of baggage behind him, that voters were opting against them, particularly independent voters. Now, I think the race is still going to be close. We're still rating as a toss-up. I mean, it was just decided by 1 percentage point last time. Of course, Warnock was right under 50%. But we are seeing in the polling continue to be a large split of independents toward Warnock. And that's really key.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the former president. He has maybe surprisingly heeded calls to largely stay out of this runoff. But clearly he did not stay out of the midterms broadly. And I'm wondering kind of what your big picture takeaways are nationally. You know, here in California, we were out on the trail with multiple congressional districts that nothing changed, like nothing flipped here, you know, and yet obviously Congress, power of Congress did. So what are your kind of big takeaways?
Well, at least from the Senate landscape, it clearly shows me that candidates matter. I mean, really, Senate elections were becoming more parliamentary in nature. And really, I believed actually that voters would be choosing a party and not necessarily a candidate, especially when we looked at all of the other historic indicators that we had, given that the president's party typically loses seats in the House and in the Senate. Right. You look at where the economy was, where Biden's approval rating was, but I go back to what I was hearing in a lot of focus groups of swing voters. And it was just that they saw many of these candidates not palatable to them. You know, you had Blake Masters in Arizona that had, you know, written things praising the Unabomber and Hitler. Like, they could recite those things. They knew that. And they just felt like it was disqualifying. And while Trump is not going there, he actually didn't campaign super close to the election for Walker anyway, really. And, you know, he's no fan of Brian Kemp necessarily. You do see Republicans in the state, they're leaning far more on Brian Kemp. He has campaigned with Walker. They didn't really campaign together during the election, which is noteworthy, though there is an issue there with campaign coordination in state versus federal races. And they're using, his field program that was far superior to Walker's as well. But I still think it comes down to candidate. Like, you can't just plop this in and this candidate is going to win, because when you had both of them on the ballot, he underperformed by more than 200,000 votes.
Jessica Taylor with the Cook Political Report. Thanks so much for joining us. And we'll be looking forward to your reporting between now and Tuesday, Wednesday, yeah. Thursday of next week. Probably going to be another tight one.
I'm hoping it's going to be counting quickly.
All right. Thanks so much. All right. We're going to turn now to Raul Bali. He's a politics reporter for WABE in Atlanta, also co-host of the Georgia Votes 2022 podcast. And he's joining us from a rally for Herschel Walker. That's the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate in Woodstock, Georgia. Hey there.
Hey.
So tell us a little bit about where you are and what you're expecting at this rally.
So this is one of the northern suburbs of Atlanta, very Republican area. And we expect Herschel Walker to do what he's been doing up until the general election and since the general election, which is focusing on, you know, red meat, Republican issues. He's really not tried to turn for the center. He's really been focusing on his base voters in this runoff.
And, I mean, do you have any sense from talking to folks? Obviously, people going to a rally like that are going to be Walker supporters. But we saw, you know, Brian Kemp outperform Herschel Walker so significantly. Do you have any sense about whether some Republicans are just going to stay home?
There is absolutely the possibility that there could be some Republicans that stay home. You know, we've been trying to reach out to those voters and find those voters of that, you know, those 200,000 that voted for Brian Kemp for governor and did not vote for Herschel Walker, his fellow Republican in the U.S. Senate race. And that is one of the big questions, is what will those voters do? Now, one of the big efforts is Governor Brian Kemp has now come full force to support Herschel Walker with commercials, with a campaign stop already. And so that's part of this effort. And also the use of Brian Kemp's pretty significant campaign machine, including data operations and his door knockers. So you see the governor now, you know, with his campaign done, going full force for Walker.
You saw some criticism recently of some Republicans who are concerned that Herschel Walker has been kind of quiet. He was off the campaign trail for the holiday, which was not the case for Reverend Warnock, Senator Warnock. Is this sort of, something he's been sort of pushed into doing, and why was he absent anyway?
You know, the only thing that we had heard was there was a birthday party, for some of his family. That there was also Thanksgiving, but no real explanation. You know, we're not getting a lot as reporters from the Walker campaign. What we do get from the Walker campaign generally are responses on Twitter, whether it's from his campaign manager or other staffers. Yeah, there's been concern from Republicans about the Walker campaign, not just, you know, being off the trail for a few days around Thanksgiving, but there's just other things and, you know, other approaches and, you know, how they answer questions. There's been a lot of questions around the Walker campaign, especially in a state where all the other statewide candidates won without a runoff.
I mean, yeah, I do wonder, though, if, you know, when you see Reverend Warnock out there on the campaign trail, he seems to be really exciting the base. We've seen President Obama come out campaign for him. Is there more excitement on the Democratic side, or is it hard to tell still?
You know, when you go to rallies on either side, as you said, you know, these are the most hardcore supporters, and you do see the energy on both sides. The question is, what's going on at the polls? Where are you seeing, you know, the longer lines or the shorter lines? right now we've been seeing longer lines in Democratic leaning areas. That doesn't mean there's not a large turnout in the more rural and suburban parts of Atlanta that support Republican candidates. So, a lot of this is us trying to read the tea leaves mm-hmm. and figure out what's going on. One of the interesting tea leaves is you've had 40,000 voters who've already cast ballots who didn't vote in November, but they've showed up for the runoff. And
wow.
That's one of the groups of people we're trying to figure out. Who are these people?
Right.
Who
that's kind of wild.
Where
yeah.
Where were you? I'm wondering, Trump himself is not, he's kind of laid low. He has not made any presence known in the state. He's apparently doing some video thing with Herschel Walker. But I'm wondering if you've heard from any pro-Trump voters who wish the former president was more of a presence in this campaign.
I think if we hear that, that would be after this runoff. And, if there is, if he loses and they're second guessing. Yes, you've heard from some, Trump supporters who wish that he was here. But you know what? When you go to a Herschel Walker rally like the one I'm about to go to, you do see, the MAGA hats. You do see the Trump hats. So, his support is there. And even though he's not stepped foot in this state since March.
Yeah. So, we mentioned that this is a truncated time frame in terms of voting, 4 weeks compared to eight or nine in the last 2 years ago, because we never stop having elections, it seems. Any impact that you're hearing directly from voters? Like, is that more challenging? People seem to be turning out, but obviously there's so much less time that, it still could be lower numbers.
The issue is because this runoff is so much shorter and early voting is a week and just a handful of days. That's why you're seeing these lines. It's such a condensed period for people to vote. And absolutely, I've heard it not only from voters out there, but even people in my own life of when am I going to show up to vote? How am I going to work around these long lines? Because you're seeing, 1 to 2 hour lines, depending. I went really early Sunday morning and was just fine because I was really one of the first people there. But then you had my coworker, Sam Greenglass, who took almost 2.5 hours to vote today. So those are the decisions people are having to make.
Yeah. And is that more true in precincts where there are a lot of people of color? Because, Democrats, of course, were unhappy with some of these changes to the voting laws that raised the barrier to voting, made it harder to vote. Is there a disproportionate effect of that?
The reality is the bigger counties in Georgia are Democratic leaning, and those are heavily counties of color. That's just the reality of that's how many more voters are trying to vote in those bigger areas, whereas the smaller, more rural parts of Georgia, they're more Republican leaning, and they're not going to face kind of those challenges. They're not going to have as many voting locations, but what you're seeing here, for example, in the Atlanta area, and seeing in some of the smaller cities is you are seeing lines because, it's a condensed voting schedule.
Yeah. All right. Just a few seconds left here. What are you going to be watching the most on Election Day?
If we have long lines again, if mm-hmm. on Election Day itself, because you're going into this Election Day versus what happened in November, there's still going to be a lot more people who hadn't voted yet. And the question is there a possibility you're going to see longer lines or longer waits on Election Day?
Or weather. Always looking for weather.
All right. Well, we'll be hearing about it, I'm sure, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, as those votes are counted. It seems to take a long time. But that is Democracy. Raul Bally reporting from a rally about to happen for Herschel Walker. He's with WABE in Atlanta. And good luck. Stay safe. And we'll look forward to more of your reporting between now and Tuesday.
Sounds good.
All right. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be joined by longtime Pelosi watcher Mark Sandalo. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. And we continue our post-election analysis with a look at the changing faces of leadership in the House. Joining us for that is Mark Sandelow of the University of California's D.C. Center in Washington. He's also the author of Madam Speaker, a biography of Nancy Pelosi. Mark, welcome to the Breakdown.
Good to be with you guys.
So, Nancy Pelosi, big picture thoughts, first of all, on her legacy. There was a lot of speculation about how she would leave leadership. Now those answers have been given. But what are your thoughts about her two terms as speaker and her legacy there?
Well, in terms of legacy, I mean, it's not only in San Francisco. There will be a Pelosi building, certainly in Washington. You know, there's a Rayburn building now and a Longworth building named after famous speakers. Republicans are going to hate it. The same way the Democrats hated it when they named National Airport across the Potomac Reagan Airport. But I mean, she is historic by any measure. I mean, arguably the most powerful speaker in a century since people like Longworth. But the fact that she did it as a woman was obviously extraordinarily, remarkable. And I always go back to, like, when you think of people like Tip O'Neill or Sam Rayburn, at age 37, one of them, Rayburn, was already been elected four times to the House, and he had been head of the Texas House of Representatives. Tip O'Neill up in Massachusetts at age 37, he was already Speaker of the Massachusetts House. Nancy Pelosi, when she was 37, was at home with a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 6-year-old. That is a very different story than anyone else in Washington can tell.
It makes my head hurt thinking about that time, and it seems like The five kids would have been easier in some ways than the 435
Couldn't wait to get
members.
Out of the house.
That's what she always said.
Yeah, she's told us that too. But I'm wondering, I mean, I heard that you were a little surprised by the fact that she decided to step down from leadership when she did and how she did. And I think we've all been talking in our newsroom for years about what's going to happen. She had made this promise to step down at the end of this, cycle from leadership. I think a lot of us didn't expect she would want to stick around and still be in Congress, not as leader.
But she's done it before. And that's the reason, after Democrats lost the majority in 2010, she was the first speaker since Sam Rayburn to say, I'm going to stick around. And she did that because she had things that she still wanted to do. That's still the case. I mean, Kevin McCarthy, as you guys have just been talking about, is going to have a very thin majority in the House. That means he's going to have to reach across the aisle to work with Democrats. And I think most people in Washington believe nobody is better equipped to maximize the Democratic advantage if Kevin McCarthy comes knocking than Nancy Pelosi.
But that's going to be awkward for the new guy, right?
Yeah, Hakeem Jeffries is going to be, the minority leader there. Do you think in her heart of hearts she would have liked to stick around? She did cut this deal with progressives a few years ago to leave at this time.
I've got no doubt. But, not that I have any inside information, but Pelosi has always felt that she can do this better than anybody else. And as much as all politicians, I suppose, feel that way, and many people in other professions feel that way, I mean, there's good evidence to support that. She's raised more money than virtually any Democrat in history. She's led them to victories that they never had before. She's something that Washington had never seen, and that was a woman who was essentially a smoke-filled room, backroom politician who was a brilliant tactician. And, even going into this last election, no one took her seriously when she said Democrats are not going to do badly. We won't even keep our majority. They didn't keep their majority, but they did better than any of the public pundits said.
Yeah. We want to get to McCarthy in a little bit, but I do want to ask, there is no love lost between Nancy Pelosi and Kevin McCarthy, both Californians. Do you think her decision to stick around has anything to do with
torturing him?
Yeah. Like being a thorn in his side.
Partly, this is all speculation. Partly, when we're talking about Hakeem Jeffries, I mean, I do think she sees herself as a mentor. And this was her hand-picked person. She endorsed him. So I think part of it is she feels like she can be of great help to him. And, there's something very cynical to me about running for re-election losing your leadership post and then saying to the people of San Francisco, thanks for voting for me for another 2 years, but nah, it's not worth it anymore. So I'm going to step down. You guys can pay for a special election. And she may want to avoid that. And then on a more selfish possibility, it's conceivable, and I certainly don't know any inside information on this, people talking about her daughter Alexandra wanting to run.
Christine.
Alexandra is
the filmmaker
who has a film about
she'll
her
document the whole thing.
And if Christine were to run, there are some people who assume that Pelosi will time her departure in a way that maximizes Christine's chances. Who knows?
But you don't think she's thinking about Kevin that much?
You know,
he's not as much fun to torture as Trump was.
The word she used for him is he's a moron.
We can leave it there. Okay.
Well, let's talk about Kevin McCarthy. What is he facing? I mean, he obviously has a smaller majority than the Democrats had, or roughly the same, 6 or 7 seats. What does he face? I mean, how big of a struggle, first of all, is it going to be for him to get enough votes to become speaker?
It's a big struggle because he's going to need, because every Democrat will vote against him. So he needs to get all but, you know, a couple of Republicans, and they're already a couple of Republicans have said they're absolutely not going to vote for him. You never really believe that. I mean, his problem is, Pelosi had this problem too. There are some people who are way off the deep end in the Republican Party on the right. I mean, you know, you've got people like Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia who blames California wildfires on laser beams orchestrated by the Rothschild family. You can't deal rationally with people like that. Now, she actually is going to vote for her. I believe she's endorsed him, and I know that Laura Boebert, another one, has endorsed him. But there are others, Matt Gaetz in Florida, who says absolutely he will not vote. He's a Republican for McCarthy. So chances are he pulls it off. But he's going to be emboldened to whoever votes for him. And what it means is, I mean, Republicans weren't going to pass sweeping legislation. They don't have the Senate. They don't have the presidency. They can't.
Or the interest,
they've
really.
But they have to pass a budget. There are some other basic things they have to do, or government can't operate. He's very likely going to need Democratic votes to do the basic functioning of the House. That's going to be interesting to see how that works.
Well, and how does that work? Because doesn't that then sour the hard right on him if he goes looking for those votes? And, you know, they're really interested in the hard right, that is, investigating the Biden administration. They've talked about investigating Pelosi. I mean, it seems to me that Democrats wouldn't have a lot of reason to play ball with McCarthy either. So where does that leave him?
Well, I mean, there are certainly people, and I say this of Republicans and Democrats, who look beyond party affiliation. I mean, there's certain things like passing a budget, which if it doesn't happen, the country pays a serious price. Raising the debt ceiling is another thing. It's just one of those functions they have to do. And you always can convince some people that that's more important than party. But again, this is where we're going to find out how good Nancy Pelosi was. Because Pelosi had people on her fringe, too, who absolutely refused to vote. I mean, Barbara Lee refused to vote for a defense budget her entire time in Congress because she's opposed to the military spending. That makes it very difficult to pass a federal budget when the margin is small. Pelosi.
Oh, you'd think Barbara Lee would have been there for Pelosi if she needed the vote.
Well, so that's exactly it, Scott. I mean, and indeed, when Nancy Pelosi needed, she could go to people like Lee and say, look, you know my heart. You know my district. I'm as liberal almost, maybe, if you are, you got to trust me on this. Pragmatism needs to win out here. I don't know whether or not McCarthy has that kind of credibility with the right wing of his party.
What is it that the Freedom Caucus, the most extreme, you know, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, although there aren't a lot of her, but, you know, the others, Jim Jordan. Yeah. I mean, what is it about McCarthy they don't like or trust?
Right. He was close to Trump, or sometimes he was.
Yeah,
you know,
like Kevin.
He's moved right and rightward.
What has he done?
Look at what he said about January 6th. You know, his initial reaction, because clearly he was scared when he listened to what he said that day, was this is Trump's fault. We can't, you know, this is a problem. And then, you know, 2 days later, he's talking about how Trump's not to blame. And, you know, it suggests more of a cravenness than. So I think people don't trust him because they see him as sort of a typical Paul who will say whatever is needed to be said. He also is, and we can say the same when we start talking about Hakeem Jeffries, to be the leader, you have to be reasonable. You cannot take an extreme position because you don't get anywhere. And people on the extremes get very frustrated at that.
Yeah. Talking of Hakeem Jeffries, he's the newly elected Democratic leader. Tell us a little bit about him. I mean, we're so used to in San Francisco having Pelosi as leader for so long. Will he, do you think, sort of lead in her image? Is he a very different type of, you know, sort of tactical politician?
So the things I have heard, I mean, it's amazing. I heard Reverend Al Sharpton, who knows Jeffries well because they're both New Yorkers. He says his heart is progressive, but his style is moderate. That's exactly what they say about Nancy Pelosi.
Absolutely.
It's like he is a lefty, but he knows he has to govern from the center. Now, whether or not that means he'll be successful, we'll find out. So remember, to get to where he is now, I guess it was 4 years ago, he beat out to get to Democratic leadership. He beat out Barbara Lee. That was to become chair of the Democratic caucus. That left a sour taste in a lot of progressives' mouths. Him and AOC. So AOC represents the district just north of him in New York City. They have not gotten along. She wants somebody who's much more bombastic. And it goes back to this fascinating, I mean, some of you will remember, Harry Britt, who was Harvey Milk's protege, who served on the Board of Supervisors, who ran against Pelosi back in 1987, the only serious challenge she ever had. Britt always contended that if you come from a progressive district like San Francisco, you don't play the role of the moderate, reasonable person. You go out there and you push the extreme, push the envelope so that the left then can move to the left without seeming so crazy. And that was his view. Pelosi obviously had a very, very different tack.
Yeah, I'm thinking Harry Britt never would have been speaker if he had won that race.
Which he acknowledges completely.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, let me ask you, though, about another Californian who was just elected to the leadership team from the Democratic Party, and that is Pete Aguilar from Redlands, the former mayor of Redlands. He's 43 years old, Latino.
January 6th committee member.
He was on the January 6th committee. We talked with him about that a few months ago. Like, what's your take on him? He's young. He's obviously a rising star in the party.
So, I mean, to be truthful, I can't tell you a whole lot about his, legislative record. I know that people like him a lot on Capitol Hill, so he gets along with a bunch of different sides. There obviously is a diversity issue that's really important here. With his election, there will be no white men in the Democratic leadership anymore. And, the Democratic Party, if only white men voted, let me put it this way. The last time white people elected a Democratic president was 1964 and Lyndon Johnson. So without women votes, without minority votes, the Democratic Party doesn't exist. And, obviously capturing Latinos, African-Americans, as Jeffries is, women who, and there's the woman, the new whip will be a woman, Catherine Clark from Massachusetts. These are going to be absolutely critical if Democrats want to win elections.
And yet they're all from coastal liberal states and
different kind of diversity.
Yeah. I wonder if that could have any impact.
Pete Buttigieg can't be everywhere.
He's certainly trying, though.
it's true. Obviously, you have pockets. I mean, Democrats represent urban America at this point. There's no doubt about it. So, I mean, yes, you could have people. I'm thinking wearing, Chicago, Detroit, New Orleans. There are other places that aren't on the same coast that we're talking about, but these are big urban areas because more and more we're seeing an urban-rural divide in Congress.
Looking ahead to the new Congress, and of course, one of the things Freedom Caucus wants that McCarthy seems more than happy to give them is hearings on things, investigations into the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago, into, Merrick Garland, more generally, President Biden, Hunter Biden. How is that going to go over, do you think, in the country, beyond the Republican caucus in the House?
So, I mean, what they had when they were in control, I think they had 5 hearings on Benghazi to prove that Hillary Clinton somehow is at fault. And even the Republicans who went after her basically concluded they really couldn't pin anything on her. If they don't find anything, they're going to look like fools. But of course, that'll be in the eye of the beholder. Their base is going to love it, which is why somebody like Jim Jordan can push it, because it's not going to hurt him in rural Ohio, which is where he needs his votes. Nationally, and again, I say this from my, I live on the East Coast. I talk you know, with West Coast media. So obviously I have a different, you know, view of this. It seems to me that investigating an insurrection on January 6th is of more national concern than what's on the president's son's laptop. If it turns out that there are big national security secrets that Hunter Biden was hiding, yeah, that's a problem. It seems like this is exactly the kind of thing where Republicans shoot themselves in the foot.
Yeah. And, you know, that never stopped them before. You know, and of course, you know, I think the Benghazi hearings is what tripped up Kevin McCarthy. For students of history may remember, he was bragging that it brought down Hillary Clinton's polling numbers, which it did, but also not seen as a brilliant move. All right. We're going to let you go. That is all for us. Mark Sandalo with the UC Center in D.C. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
And that's it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Guy Marzorati.
I'm Scott Schaefer. For more politics coverage from KQED, subscribe to the Political Breakdown newsletter. You'll find it at kqed.org/newsletters. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time, everybody.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.